case we start. Today's seminar will be given by Professor Romali. What is the phase shift measured in the iron bomb in the front?
Okay, so I chose to pose the title as a question, and I'll give several answers. As the talk goes on, the main topic will be understanding the so-called Aharonov-Bohm thermometer. This is work done in collaboration with people from three out of the five important universities in Israel. Orienting is here, and jointly is here, and then, to be honest, this collaboration also involved Yoshua and Schiller. Outline, I will start with an introduction which will discuss the double slit experiments and the related Aharonov-Bohm interferometers, as I will try to convince you there are several issues which concern the double slit experiment and the Aharonov-Bohm interferometer, which are not discussed in full detail in the textbooks, which address the double slit. In particular, after a long experimental review, I will move on to explain the Onsager relations, which have a direct bearing on some of the experiments done with Aharonov-Bohm interferometers. And then I will describe several calculations in which I will describe solutions for various geometries of quantum dots placed in various places, and I will explain that as I will go along. Now, the double slit experiment is in all the textbooks of quantum mechanics, usually in section one, and I chose to present here first the example of the Feynman lectures, because Feynman is probably the only textbook who did pay attention to some of the issues that I will emphasize during this talk. Feynman starts the lecture notes from two experiments, an experiment with bullets, and then he has an experiment with waves, which I skip, and then he has an experiment with electrons. And what I want to draw your attention to are these words which he uses in describing the bullet experiment. He says that in front of the gun, we are in the gun of bullets, and in front of the gun we have a wall made of armor plates that have in it two holes just about big enough to let a bullet through. These are the two slits. Beyond the wall is a backstop, say a thick wall of wood, says he, which will absorb the bullets when they hit it. So the bullets are allowed to go through these slits. This is a strong wall of armor plate. The bullets cannot go through it. They are reflected from it. And then when they go through and they find their way to the screen, they get stuck in the screen and are absorbed there. Remember these words. We'll come back to them later. And then this is going on to the experiment with electrons, and you all know the difference. With bullets you have that, and with electrons you have an interference picture here, and the magnitude of the probability to find an electron on this screen is the sum of the wave functions going through the two paths. absolute value square, and this is the basis for the explanations of quantum mechanics in all these textbooks. A more recent textbook, like Gazyorovich, refines this story by adding the Aharonov-Bohm effect into it, and then you put a magnetic flux inside the loop surrounded by the two paths, and then, is it focused? I found. Well, maybe that's the best one can do, but I have rewritten it down here. You have a flux, and the flux is related to a phase via a prefactor E over CH bar, and then what you have here is a sum of the quantum amplitude of this wave and the quantum amplitude of this wave. However, between them there is an extra phase E to the I phi, this phase, and then if you assume that the amplitude here is indeed the sum of these amplitudes including this extra phase, then you end up with an intensity here which is the square of this wave function, and that square, because of this extra phase, has a term which comes from the interference, and that's a cosine of alpha 1 minus alpha 2, which is the difference of the phases between the two paths, say the optical lengths that the electron would go through here or here, plus this phase phi coming from the Aharonov-Bohm effect. So this is basically the Aharonov-Bohm interferometer idea. The idea is that by looking at this cosine and by repeating the measurements in different magnetic fields, if one then has a handle by which one can vary these phases alpha 1 and alpha 2, then the shift in the cosine term will give you a handle on measuring these phases, and hence information on whatever elements you had on one path relative to the other. Okay, so this is the two-slit experiment and the Aharonov-Bohm interferometer. In fact, experimentally, this Aharonov-Bohm effect was immediately discussed in the literature. Aharonov-Bohm was 1959. In 1960, there was this paper by Chambers who used a refined electron microscope, which was switched to become an interferometer, and using that electron microscope, he was able to measure this phase of the magnetic flux. However, and since then there were many experiments using microscopes, etc. However, the recent history of this topic begins with doing that sort of experiment with mesoscopic systems, and the reason one had to go in experiments to very small loops is the issue of coherence, on which we have been hearing a lot during the last 2 weeks. To have the electrons coherent, you want to have it small enough so that the mean free path is long enough, and then you can have the interference. And Webb and company, at the suggestions of some theoreticians, constructed this sort of mesoscopic system with submicron gold rings, and then they put a magnetic flux through that ring, and they measured oscillations with period H over E, which is related to the H over E that I had over here, and so the angle phi in these oscillations was a confirmation of the Aharonov-Bohm experiment in this geometry. And then some textbooks, when they discuss the Aharonov-Bohm experiment, present it A with this geometry,
and with the magnetic field inside, and then probably following the Webb et al. Experiment, textbooks also have this geometry in which you should remember the electrons are restricted to move in these narrow quasi one-dimensional waveguides. So for example, the book by Schwabel, which I didn't find in the library here, and therefore I didn't copy it, in the same chapter on Aharonov-Bohm experiment also gives you that sort of geometry, and still writes down the same formula like here, or in fact, if you take Schwabel for that geometry, he writes it with the phases alpha 1 and alpha 2 coming from the interference between that path and that path. By the end of this talk, you will have the message that that geometry and that geometry are not really equivalent, and we'll discuss the differences between them. In any case, what these guys measured and everybody else following them measured was the conductance through that sort of instrument via the Landauer formula is proportional to the transmission coefficient, and the transmission coefficient, if you assume that the transmission through that ring, the amplitude is the sum of these two amplitudes with this Aharonov-Bohm phase, if you assume that, then you end up with the conductance being a periodic function of phi like that, and then one can draw conclusions on the phases, and in particular attempt to draw conclusions on the phase difference between these two paths. And indeed, the next step, so this was a mesoscopic ring, and then there were also experiments with the actual double slit experiment, however, on a two-dimensional electron gas, and by constructing the appropriate metallic pieces on the gas, you have the source, you have the two slits, you have the absorber at the other end, and indeed, people measured oscillations through which they tried to draw conclusions on what is the phase difference between these different paths. And I'm probably choosing here a selected collection of experiments, but then the same people, after they did the two-slit experiment, which is this open geometry, they also did a more closed ring-like geometry, and this is the sort of geometry you see more and more in the literature more recently, and the idea now is that you have the two paths for the electron. These are two narrow paths now, so again the waveguide geometry and not the double slit geometry, and then there is a quantum dot placed on one of the paths, and the purpose then is to say when an electron is transmitted through a quantum dot, it accumulates a transmission phase of the dot, which we'll discuss more and more as this talk goes on, and therefore there is hope that this interference sort of structure will yield information on this phase relative to that phase. And indeed, in this particular experiment, they were in the Coulomb blockade regime, and therefore, first of all, as function of the magnetic field, the current oscillates, so we have the Aharonov-Bohm oscillations, and then what they emphasize is that as the parameters are scanned through a single Coulomb peak, the parameter that is varied is this gate voltage here, which allows one to vary the number of electrons on the dot. So you have Coulomb peaks, and they observe an abrupt phase change of pi whenever one went through a Coulomb peak. So the idea is that these experiments claim to have a tool by which they can measure the phase of the quantum dot, and in particular, they can measure changes in that phase as function of the parameters of the a circuit, and in particular there are changes of pi at resonances, which we'll also come back to. But anyway, this is just an example of such an experiment, and then following that came more experiments on this, again with emphasis on the idea that the double slit interference geometry allows you measurements of phases, and here is a more elaborate structure with the same principles. However, this geometry is somewhat different from the previous geometry, and I'll come back to that again later. Basically, it's the same idea, right? You have two paths, and you have the quantum dot on one of the paths. Here also, you have the two paths, and you have the quantum dot on one of the paths, and the hope is to measure the phase shift from the current oscillations coming out through there. The difference between these experiments and these experiments have to do with these openings to the sides here and here, which are absent there. And I'll come back to that as I go on with this talk. Anyway, these people, when they did this experiment, the way they interpreted their measured results was based on this sort of logic. A, they assumed what I'll be calling the double slit formula from now on, namely the conductance is proportional to the transmission, the transmission amplitude is the sum of these two amplitudes with the Aharonov-Bohm phase, and then what we need are expressions for each of these T amplitudes. The amplitude going through the dot is written as a Bright-Wigner formula with a width and a resonance, and being a complex number, it has a phase, and this phase theta is then identified as the phase that I called alpha 1 previously. That's the phase of the dot, and then there is a phase of the other path, and eventually one ends up with a cosine of the Aharonov-Bohm phase plus the phase difference between the two paths, and the interpretation finally is that one can measure the phase of the quantum dot, which is related directly to this arctans of E minus E n over gamma, or in fact to the phase of the Bright-Wigner formula or the Green's function on the dot. And the aim of the talk today is to discuss these issues, in particular what determines gamma, the width of the of this resonance in the these geometries, and what is the phase theta that one would be measuring from such a geometry. What these people got when they used these interpretations, I won't go into all the details of their experiments, but typically again, all of these, any of these papers that you take off the literature have a magnetic field and then a current, and you have Aharonov-Bohm-like oscillations, and then one studies these oscillations as function of whatever external parameters are, for example, the gate voltage, plunger gate voltage, and you see peaks in the current, but you also see information on the phase. So here is the intensity, and here is the phase, and the phase typically, when you go through such a Coulomb blockade peak, the phase changes by pi, going from, this is the phase in units of pi, and you see such curves, and there are more of these. There are these guys also see that this grows from zero to pi as you go through a Coulomb blockade peak, and then abruptly there is a so-called phase slip by pi down, and then it goes on. And not all of these features are understood theoretically, but the experiments give what they give, and our aim is to discuss these results critically and see what the interpretation should involve. The same group with various subsets then cooled the system to very low temperature, and then this is roughly the same circuit, you don't see it much here, but then they say that they can cool it down below the Kondo temperature of the dot, and then again the typical experiments are the Coulomb blockade peaks and the phases measured through the magnetic field dependence of the current. So you see the oscillations and you extract a phase through that interpretation. And as you see, the magnitude of the current has these even odd oscillations, which indicate that perhaps they are in the Kondo regime. The phase shows funny features. Here are some of the phases that they here are some of the results of the phases. So here is a typical phase measured as a function of the gate voltage, and it increases from zero to pi, but once they are in the Kondo regime, there are various strange phenomena on the way. Here is a phase going up, jumping, going up, all kinds of strange features of the phase in these experiments. And then even more recently, they went on and had even a smaller system and yet lower temperatures. And then the phases in this measurement, the phase has such a strange variation, again between zero and pi, but instead of going rather quickly to zero to pi, from zero to pi, or in fact, in some of the previous experiments that I didn't show you, the phase would go up to pi over 2 and then stick at pi over 2 and then go up to pi, and that pi over 2 has been also identified as a signature of the Kondo effect. There are funny phenomena observed when people measure phases through such interferometry, and the aim of this seminar then is to attempt to address these phases theoretically and see if we can make some statements on what is one really measuring and what are the cautions that one should be aware of. So to summarize everything I told you so far, there is the double slit experiment, the double slit formula, which is in all these textbooks. And if T1 and T2 have phases alpha 1 and alpha 2, the cosine oscillating term as function of the magnetic flux might, if this formula is correct, teach us about the phase alpha 1 of T1, which through such bright Wigner interpretations might tell us something about the quantum dot. Experiments indeed give such a cosine. They have a phase shift, which I'll now call beta, to distinguish from alpha 1 minus alpha 2. And the question posed by this talk is, when is this measured phase beta equal to this phase difference between the two paths? And if it is, does it really tell us about the phase of the quantum dot, alpha 1? And if this is not true, what really is beta that is measured in the experiment, and what can we say about it? So this is the end of the introduction. Now, as I said, I will present three answers to this question. And the first answer is related to the Onziger relations. We are discussing here a conductance as function of a magnetic field. And Onziger already told us that if you measure such response functions, the conductance is a diagonal term in the Onziger matrix of responses. If time reversal symmetry holds, and if unitarity holds, unitarity in the sense of conservation of electron number or conservation of the electron probability current, then, says Onziger, G of a magnetic field should be an even function of the magnetic field. The conductance at flux phi should be equal to the conductance at flux minus phi. And these are very robust assumptions that one can do little to change, but we'll see later.
I think actually unitarity is not even needed. Particularly if you have, there's a bit optics, right? You can talk about transmittances. and you can have absorption. Scattering matrix will be symmetric even if there's absorption.
Okay. This is not the scattering matrix, but...
No, but it follows. It follows
yeah.
from the symmetry.
Wait and see. Unitarity here will become important, as I will explain. But anyway, if you buy that already, that's fine. If G is an even function of the magnetic field, then there is no escape. The expansion of G as function of the angle phi must be an even function, and you can expand it in a Fourier transform, in a Fourier series if you wish, with cosine phi and cosine 2 phi or whatever, but all these cosines better be even functions of phi, which means that if you want to discuss the term linear in a cosine, that phi should not have a beta. If this was cosine of phi plus beta, that would break the Onsager relation. That cannot be. So if these assumptions hold, the phase shift beta better be zero. However, the experiment, as I told you, measure beta. So what's wrong here? I come back to this strong assumption. Carlo was willing to abandon it, but unitarity means that there is a conservation of the electron currents, which means that the system is closed. If I go back to some of the experiments that I showed you, and I will probably not find the ones I want, but definitely in this sort of experiment, the electrons are restricted to move only within these waveguides. It's a completely closed geometry. Every electron that comes in through here either gets reflected or gets through. This is a closed geometry. In this closed geometry, Onsager would require that beta be zero, no phase shift. In this experiment, unfortunately, the zero of the field was not clear, so all they could was measure the period of the oscillations. They didn't measure the zero. But if one would repeat this sort of experiment with a completely closed geometry, one better not have a phase in the cosine here. So this is the first answer. And in fact, the experimentalists were made aware of this by the theorists rather early in the game. If I go through these pictures of experiments that I showed you, then you will realize that, for example, in this experiment in which there were these narrow paths for the electrons, this is a closed system just like that system. There is no loss of current anywhere, and therefore for this experiment one should expect just a cosine phi and not a cosine phi plus beta. The theorists explained this to the experimentalists, and as a result came the next experiment and all the experiments ever after, which look like this, and I already hinted at these open regions here. They opened the system in order to overcome Onsager. If you read the papers, it's that information is somewhat hidden in the write-up. You have to read very carefully to even notice that this system is open as opposed to that system. But clearly, without such openings, one would not see a phase shift. So indeed, they opened the system, and all the next experiments are also open, and they measured the phase. And that phase was what I was calling beta.
It's like beta was zero. That's the thing that I gave a bit late.
Beta was zero in this experiment, yes. Zero or pi, right? It has to be an even function of. But again, this is not emphasized in that literature because people somehow, they realize we have to open. Okay, so we open it and here is a phase and we are happy. However, the next logical question remains
if, I don't guess that the language we used to use is that they want to go from a two-terminal measurement to a four-terminal measurement. Isn't that?
I don't think so. That's not having to do with the four-terminal. They don't necessarily measure through these openings.
As soon as you have other terminals where the electrons can disappear, and you're no longer doing a two-terminal measurement, you're doing a
terminal. That's true. You have terminals. You don't measure on those terminals, but you have other terminals. Correct.
But there is some.
They did not necessarily use these terminals to measure, say, a voltage.
No, but the common language, at least as it was in the 80s, in connection also with these experiments by Webb, were also not symmetrical and zero. They said it had to do because they had more terminals and they were only measuring a certain number of the terminals and not all the terminals.
That's what they did, yes. But the hidden motivation behind doing that was just this issue of Onziger. Otherwise, they wouldn't measure a phase shift. Now, if you...
There is a reciprocity, though. This experiment, if I view this as a six-lead experiment, then there is a symmetry...
I'll come back.
...6x6 matrix under B goes to minus B, right?
The 6x6 scattering matrix will be unitary. And I'll come back to that. However, the actual experiment measures only a 2x2 submatrix of that 6x6 matrix, and that 2x2 submatrix is not unitary. And that's the whole issue that I will develop gradually from now on. Having said all this, this question becomes more tricky, because if I told you that you have to break unitarity in order to measure beta, then you might logically conclude that the magnitude of beta should depend on how you break the unitarity, because beta has to go to zero when the unitarity breaking goes to zero, so there should be some sort of continuous dependence on the amount of unitarity breaking and the magnitude of beta. And if that is so, then beta most probably might not be equal to this phase difference between the two paths, because this does not contain any information on the unitarity breaking. So our purpose in starting this project was to address exactly that issue. What are the conditions under which beta will be equal to this phase difference between the two paths? And in most cases, probably beta will not be equal to this phase difference. What is really beta? How does it depend on the amount of unitarity breaking? And how can we interpret experiments which give us beta as teaching us something about the quantum dot? But I remind you the Feynman comment, who carefully said that the first wall should be made of strong metal that reflects all the bullets, and the second wall should absorb all the bullets. So clearly, Feynman did not have in mind a unitary situation in which every bullet that comes in is accounted for. Many of Feynman's bullets were lost. Many of his electrons were lost. Was he really thinking about the fact that you have to break unitarity to recover the two-slit formula? We'll never know. I suspect that maybe he did. So, having said Onziger, it is next interesting to see, can we recover the Onziger condition with a zero phase shift by doing an explicit calculation on this sort of geometry. So the rest of this talk will be split into three calculations. The first calculation will assume unitarity, namely will assume that all the current is conserved and no electrons get lost. And what I will then do is, in the next two parts, is break unitarity in a variety of ways and discuss how does unitarity breaking affect the phase shift beta that one might measure. So in most of the literature, what you find is that people calculate the phase shift of a quantum dot by placing an ideal quantum dot with maybe one bound state or a few on a one-dimensional link to the two sides, and then solving this one-dimensional problem with the dot and obtaining a transmission amplitude and a phase. And this is the phase alpha 1 that one then would like to check, to check these theories. So I repeat, most of the theoretical papers solve that, obtain alpha 1, and then the question is, how do we measure that alpha 1? The literature then assumed, as I explained, that if you take that dot and put it now on one pass of the interferometer, then you might measure the phase alpha 1 from the phase difference that will appear in the cosine term. What I will now summarize for you is a calculation of that geometry, which just picks from that calculation and adds the other pass in parallel, and then the transmission amplitude from here, going out from here, will turn out to have this general mathematical form that I will explain in more detail. But let me now just raise your interest in this. It turns out that all the information about the quantum dot does appear in the final transmission in a prefactor which is equal to the Green's function of the dot in the presence of everything. So that Green's function of the dot does depend on the nature of these contacts and of that and of these contacts and of these fork intersections and so on. All that information is hiding in here. The phase shift alpha 1 that one would like to measure is hiding in this Green's function. However, the interference part, which involves the flux through the loop, that interference part looks like this, and it turns out that both A and B, coming out of the calculation, I'll present examples, are real numbers. So when you take the absolute value square of this part in the result, it gives you just a cosine of phi with no phase shift. It also turns out that this GD, the Green's function of the dot, will depend on the flux, but it will depend on the flux only via even functions like cosine of phi. So Onsager is saved by this explicit calculation, which is a trivial exercise that one can give to one's students in quantum mechanics. And the result is that Onsager does survive this calculation, and it's quite interesting to see how the various parameters hide in these expressions.
Question?
Yes.
I mean, you're talking about a transmission coefficient, but are you going to include interactions on this dot?
What I will argue in a minute is that the only way the Hamiltonian on the dot enters the result is via the Green's function on the dot.
But are you going to be trying to calculate conductance as a function of the field, or I don't know what you mean by
I'll
particle transmission.
Wait a few minutes.
Okay.
So that calculation, as I said, has existed in the literature in many forms, and there are probably hundreds of papers that discuss that. And one of the better papers on this is the paper by Negg and Lee, 1988, but most of this calculation was already hinted in a paper by Langres in 1966. And the Hamiltonian here basically is a tight binding hopping on the left lead and on the right lead, and then there is a TR and a TL hopping from the lead on the dot from the right and from the left. There is a site energy epsilon naught on the dot, and then there is an interaction only on the dot. This is the Hamiltonian, and then what they do is they send in a combination of incoming and outgoing waves on the left and outgoing and incoming waves on the right. These are single electron wave functions coming from the left and from the right. And then they calculate the scattering matrix connecting the functions coming in and the functions going out, the amplitudes of these plane waves coming in and coming out, and they end up with an S matrix. And I don't know if this is visible. Maybe this is a little better. Basically, what they find from, and this contains the interactions on the dot with restrictions. In particular, this calculation becomes relatively simple at zero temperature and with electrons only on the Fermi surface. If you are at zero temperature and your electrons have the Fermi energy, then the scattering matrix has the transmission and reflection coefficients. However, they are all expressed in terms of the Green's function G sigma, which is the Green's function on the dot of the of an electron with spin sigma, and all the detailed information on the interactions or what have you on the dot is hidden inside that Green's function. So that Green's function is very complicated to calculate, but let's assume that you have some techniques to calculate it. As far as the transmission of electrons through the dot is concerned, you don't need the details of that. What you need to know is that the transmission coefficient or the transmission amplitude, the transmission intensity is proportional to the Green's function with some prefactors that have to do with TL and TR, these hopping matrix elements on the sides.
Well, sort of, I'm quite missing the point here, but it seems like if you have interactions on the dot and you send in a single particle, what comes out the other end is not just a single particle, it's particle hall excitations.
Well, you are, that's why I said zero temperature and the Fermi energy. So you have no excitations for this particular model.
Yeah, okay.
So this is the calculation. In fact, the calculations that I will describe will even be simpler. I'm just presenting this to make my point. I don't really need to discuss the interactions. I could do a single electron calculation and demonstrate that without interactions, all my claims are valid. What I'm trying to say here is that even had I included the interactions on the dot, however, at zero temperature and at the Fermi energy, I would still be able to keep up with my calculations, and all that information will be shoved into the Green's function, which will appear in the prefactor and not in the interfering part. So let's forget interactions from now on. Let me just mention that once you know this Green's function on the dot, that Green's function has a phase, which is called delta, and then the transmission through this dot in this calculation has this simple symmetric form in which there is a prefactor which will become one when the dot is symmetric left and right, and there is a sine square of delta. Delta is this phase shift, and this phase shift on the dot has been related to the so-called Friedel phase of the dot. It has to do with the average occupation of electrons on the dot, and we won't need any of that in this talk. All we need to know is that by the end of such a calculation, one ends up with a one electron wave function on the left and a single electron wave function on the right, and a scattering matrix which involves the Green's function on the dot. So we'll adopt that same calculation, but since I just said that the information on the dot itself and whatever interaction the dot has will be hiding in that Green's function, I'll describe now a calculation which ignores the interactions and just expresses everything in terms of the Green's function on the dot.
Can you say precisely what you mean by the Green's function on the dot?
Yes, I'm coming. I'll do that via examples. The Green's function on the dot is, in the language of Negen Lee, this is the single electron Green's function averaged with the many-body wave function. Okay. So you take the many-body Green's function in its full glory, but then sandwich it between single electron wave functions on the left and on the right, and this is the single particle Green's function. But for our purposes, even that won't...
Just on the left and just on the right.
Yes. The dot itself, a point. This is the on-site Green's function on the dot, which I'll demonstrate via this example immediately. Imagine, for simplicity, just a tight binding trivial model, even without interactions. You have an energy epsilon naught on the dot. You have energy zero on the other sides. You have a hopping J everywhere except on the left and on the right, where you have JL and JR. And you send in a wave function which gets reflected and transmitted. And this is an exercise that everybody can do. And you end up with a transmission coefficient here, this is without interactions now, which is just proportional to the Green's function on the dot, which I, for a single electron, you know what I mean. This is just the dot dot sandwiched wave, 1 over E minus H. And what you have here is, this was the Green's function on the dot in the absence of any connections. If the dot was isolated, then it was just a diagonal with energy epsilon 0. So you had 1 over epsilon minus epsilon 0 on the dot. And having coupled it to the leads, then adds to this on-site isolated dot Green's function a piece that comes from its coupling to the leads, and it has this form with both a real and imaginary part. So the Green's function on the dot, once coupled to the leads, is a complex function which has a width gamma, which I can read off from this expression, and therefore it has a phase that I can calculate from this. This would be the phase alpha 1 that I would be using in the later calculations, and the point that I made mentioning Neg and Li is that a similar expression for the on dot wave Green's function will arise, except that these parameters, this and this and this, get renormalized by whatever interaction does. But we'll still assume that on the dot there exists some function like that, and as I will tell you, all the results that I will present today will have this part as a multiplicative prefactor. So you can now calculate the scattering matrix for this problem trivially, and you have a 2x2 S matrix, and if indeed there is no loss anywhere out of the dot, then this scattering matrix is unitary and its determinant has a phase which is directly related to the phase we were mentioning before. This is then the so-called Friedel phase, or the phase of the intrinsic phase of the dot. And as I said, if we had interactions, then as Neg and Li demonstrated, this factor of epsilon q minus epsilon naught, which reflected the isolated dot before, will be replaced by some more complicated single dot function, which may include the interaction. If the dot was coupled to a side branch which generated interactions with other electrons and condo and so on, all of that might hide in here, and we won't need that for the discussion today.
Well, this is only going to T equals zero.
Temperature zero, Fermi energy.
A Fermi liquid state.
Yeah, but the calculation I'm describing doesn't really get into all of that. For my purposes, forget interactions. All I'm saying is that to include interaction would imply to renormalize the parameters in this single dot Green's function. So I will assume there exists a Green's function that needs to be calculated self-consistently at the end of the calculation, but I won't need its details for what I'm going to say today. So the next part is then to take this element and plug it onto the Aharonov-Bohm interferometer. And this is again a trivial calculation. To make it simple, the way we dealt with it was to say that we just have a single bond of the tight binding model between this fork and the dot with amplitude Hopping matrix element JL and a matrix element here JR, which carries the phase of the Aharonov-Bohm, which by the way I could have placed on any of these around the loop, and the result doesn't depend on that. And then there is this other branch with a Hopping matrix element V, and here is a refined exercise in tight binding calculation, which every student can do. And the way we solve it is by dividing the Hamiltonian into an ordered chain, which goes like this as H0, and then H1 will contain all the corrections, namely JL and JR and the difference between V and J. And then we can just use a Green's function approach, and I doubt that I need to teach you how you do the Green's function when you have H0 and H, but you can rewrite it like this, and therefore you end up with equations for the full Green's function in terms of the bare Green's function and H1, and the number of equations is just dependent on how many matrix elements this H1 has, which is relatively simple. So we do that calculation. We can express the full wave function in terms of the unperturbed Green wave functions with this Green's function of the whole thing, and you end up with these equations for the Green's function with the loop, and in terms of the Green's function without the loop. Without the loop it's trivial, and with the loop you end up with expressions which involve all the matrix elements of the full Green's function, and let me not go into the detail. You just write the non-trivial matrix elements of the full Green's function, including the loop, and they are all expressible in terms of GCC, which is the Green's function on the dot, and factors on top of that. And by the time you clear up the details, you find that for the simple non-interacting Hamiltonian that I was using before, the Green's function on the dot itself is what it was before, plus a renormalization part, a self-energy sort of part, which does depend on these parameters, JL, JR, V, and J, and the phase phi, and Q, the wave number of the electrons. But so the main statement at this stage is forget about the details. We can express all the Green's functions that we need in order to calculate the scattering matrix in terms of this GCC, and that contains information both on the bare Green's function that was on the dot before we switched everything, and then a piece that depends on everything else. So the Green's function on the dot that we'll need at the end will depend on everything you do anywhere on the system, but the dependence of that on the flux is still an even function of phi, and that's all we will need from this expression. So you clean up the mess, you plug in a wave function coming in and the wave function going out, and you can calculate then the transmission amplitude going from left to right or going from right to left. And the important part is this expression that I already advertised, namely the transmission amplitude is proportional to the Green's function on the dot, which, as I told you, contains all the parameters of the problem. And then there is an interference piece, which you can see will exist only if all three bonds on the loop exist. You need both JL and JR to be able to go from the upper pass, and V to go through the lower pass. However, in the notations I'm using in this calculation, all of these numbers are real numbers. Phi, the magnetic phase, appears in here, and the amplitudes in front don't matter. G depended on phi also through only cosine phi, and therefore, by the time I finish the analysis, I end up with a current or a transmission amplitude T, which is the absolute value square of what I had before, and the dependence on phi is only via cosine phi, so Onsager is indeed saved from this calculation. And this is just another comment to say that if you want to put in Condor interactions or whatever, they will enter into this factor, they will not enter here, except through a renormalization of these quantities, but these quantities will remain real under those conditions. So that part and the Onsager result survive.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
So the point is that you don't measure the phase alpha.
For a unitary system with this geometry, you don't measure any phase.
What if you worked perturbatively in JL or JR, and you expect
bear with me.
Okay. Let me interrupt for a moment. I'm a little bit concerned. Many of us people do want to go for lunch also, and it's almost 1 o'clock. So I think
The next part I won't go into any detail, so I'll just run through. Do I have 10 more minutes?
Yeah, I guess 10 more minutes. But
that's all I need.
Extends much more beyond that.
No, it won't. So here is again the result of this calculation. And we had an amplitude, another amplitude, cosine phi. And let me just mention that this interference term, the term which appears in front of cosine phi, involved this product of what I had the two terms in my previous transparency. And as you see, the cosine phi appears only if all three bonds are there, but also it is proportional to epsilon q minus epsilon naught, which was the real part of the Green's function, the bare Green's function. And therefore that B will change sign every time you go through a resonance here. And therefore you could interpret a sign change in B as a jump of beta by pi. That's just a complicated way to say that the coefficient here switches sign when you go through a resonance. But in the literature, they don't say it's just a trivial change of sign. They say we have a strange phase slip of beta by pi. But those strange phase slips are nothing but a reflection that of the fact that we went through a resonance. So beta does have jumps, but those jumps are directly related to the fact that we went through resonances. It has nothing to do with intrinsic details of the properties of the dot. Now, what is the physics behind this result? This comes back to your question. The reason why we end up with Onziger is that in this geometry, unlike the open two-slit experiment of Feynman, the wave functions are restricted to these branches, and therefore, when an electron reaches this point here, some of it is reflected, some of it is transmitted that way, some of it is transmitted this way, and then it can go back and forth and go around and go back again and go back again. You need to sum up this infinite series of all the possible processes around the loop, and only then will the calculation conspire to take out the phases alpha 1 and alpha 2, take them out of the brackets and leave you only with that combination that I showed you. So perturbatively, you might mistakenly think that if you stopped at order V times JL times JR or whatever in what I showed you before, you might have thought that you have a phase, but the meaning of that would be that within your perturbation expansion, you just threw away all the possible reflections from here and all the possible reflections from here, which is exactly what Feynman anticipated when he said you need a wall of wood that will absorb everything that falls on it. Here is the wall of Feynman. Every wave that hits it gets absorbed. Nothing is reflected. Okay, so this is indeed the physics. And this is what in a closed system with no losses, Onziger must survive. So how do we overcome that in the remaining 3 minutes? There are several ways to do that. One possible simple calculation is to say, okay, let's add another link to the dot that goes into an electron reservoir there, and every electron that gets in here gets lost over there. That turns the 2x2 scattering matrix that I had before into a 3x3 scattering matrix. That 3x3 scattering matrix is still unitary. It should be. However, if I use it under the boundary conditions that everything that goes here gets lost and I don't care about it, then I'm interested here only in the 2x2 submatrix that will give me the transmission this way. That 2x2 submatrix is no longer unitary, and therefore indeed there will be a non-trivial phase accumulated as a result. In fact, the Green's function on the dot, when you attach that, you can just solve that and take out these degrees of freedom away from the calculation and renormalize your expressions. The Green's function on the dot gets an extra piece that comes from this other link. So as you see, there is a contribution from each of the links connected to the dots, contributing to the imaginary part and therefore contributing to the width of this resonance, and that's again not surprising. However, you immediately see that the phase of this Green's function is no longer the phase you wanted to measure originally, because there is a contribution to the width here from the unitarity breaking. Okay. Now you can take this and plug it into the Aharonov-Bohm interferometer. So I take this element with this piece, but remember now this Green's function has an extra piece coming from these losses, and you crank the thing, and you realize that in this formula that I had before, the only thing that changes is wherever you had epsilon naught, you now have epsilon naught plus sigma 1, sigma r coming from this extra losing channel. So this now will have a phase because this self-energy is complex. However, the phase that this carries has to do with the details of the lossy channel. It has nothing to do with the original phase we wanted to measure. So if in this circuit you measure the phase, you will be measuring the imaginary part of sigma relative to the real part of sigma. This will tell you about that loss, but nothing about what you originally wanted to measure. So this is not a good way to lose. What is a better way? A better way was already hinted by Charlie. You would like to have no reflection from here and no reflection from here. Here is a 4x4 scattering matrix at this fork that will do that for you. Every wave that comes from here goes either here or here. Every wave that comes from here goes either here or here, and never reflected. Let's put such an element here and such an element here. Don't ask me how. I don't know how to do that with electrons. Waves, this has been done, but with electrons, how to construct a potential that will conspire to give you exactly such a scattering matrix, I don't know. But if you were able to invent such a system, then you have no reflection here, no reflection here, no reflection, no reflection here. You end up with the two-path formula, with the phase on T1 and the phase on T2. So this might give you the desired answer, provided that T1 has no losses on it, and T2 has no other losses on it, because as I just told you in the previous transparency, if you have side losses, that renormalizes the phase on the dot, and then again you don't measure what you want. So what you need in order to have what they see in the experiment is no reflections from here, no reflections from here, namely lots of losses here. This is the Feynman wooden wall. However, no losses on the way. If you have that, then you recover the two-slit experiment. So, conclusion, closed systems have beta equals zero, open systems have beta not zero. However, if you want beta to be exactly the difference of the phases, then you need to conspire very carefully. Does the experiment contain these conspirations? Maybe. The experiments have additional hints to indicate that maybe they did see Kondo physics. They see it in the magnitude of the current. They see it in other details, not only in the phase. How does that happen in the actual experiment? Probably, if the losses go through here, if there are enough losses gradually from this, then the net effect of that is no reflection back from this region here. So maybe somehow putting the losses here conspires to have no reflections, and furthermore, in the region near the dot, there are no losses, so that part of the lossy branch from the dot does not arise, and then maybe the experiments do what they wanted to do. What we would like to stimulate interest here is the fact that that is definitely not conclusive, and the way to check that is to plan controlled experiments in which one controls the unitarity breaking, one controls the losses, and one sees how the phases depend on these details.
I'm not really, it's not really one-dimensional. Is it fair to say that all you need is that the width of the lid will be larger than the wavelength of the electron?
No, because you can then discuss a many-channel problem. If your full scattering matrix is still unitary, then that will not save you.
The full scattering matrix scattering matrix in the final picture is oscillatory if you take the
input. But then it's infinite and you are testing only one channel.
Yeah,
yes. So, sure, if you have, on this point, you have many also scattered electrons that go out and so on, then you don't have unitarity. The question is, do you break unitarity in this particular way that will still save you or not? Is not obvious.
If you take the width of the lid to infinity, you will get the two slit experiment.
Like probably.
How big does it?
It's not just the width. It's not just the width. No, it's not the width. It's having channels through which you go away and never come back. Having a finite width of the lead in which everything is unitary. You need to have absorption effectively one on the two forks at the two ends, and not nothing in the region of the dot itself.
We've slipped into the discussion session, I see.
Yeah, I concluded. Thank you.
Give an applause for this.